Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Entrepreneurship and Leadership Channel of the New Books Network. My name is Mark McCurgo, and I'm very pleased to be one of the hosts of this channel, along with my colleague Richard Lucas. Today we're talking about Neil Usher's new book, Elemental Change, and the subtitle is Making Stuff Happen When Nothing Stands Still. And I'm sure anyone who's been involved in entrepreneurship and leadership will recognize that challenge of everything's moving around. How do you know what to do next when it won't stand still long enough for you to see it? So, Neil, welcome to the podcast. Please introduce yourself for us.
Thank you. Hi, Mark. Delighted to be here. Thank you very much. So, yes, Neil Usher. I've been in what can loosely be described as corporate real estate for the last 30 or so years. What that has actually involved for the majority of that time is looking after large property portfolios for occupier clients from a variety of different sectors in a large number of countries around the world. And a core component, if you like, of that sort of responsibility is migrating people from one type of workplace to another. So effectively leading large and very complex change projects in a variety of different cultures and settings around the world. So although I approach this from essentially a sort of property and workplace point of view, what I hope we can cover this morning really are sort of challenges in relation to change that are generic and are applicable in any sector, any industry or any environment.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things that impressed me about the book was how many lessons you've got that are very, very widely applicable in this book. And they're also lessons that you don't often come across. So I'm very excited to have you as our guest today. So how did you come to write this book, Elemental Change, Neil?
I'd written the first book, Elemental Workplace, published in 2018. And I'd actually started down the road of thinking about I actually did a presentation at a conference even, sort of thinking about writing a second workplace book. And then I thought, well, hold on a minute, what are you doing? You've already written a workplace book, why are you writing another one? And then I thought, well, what else have I done really in all of this time? And really change became very quickly a sort of subject that I thought, well, this is something that I've spent virtually my entire working life practicing. Perhaps I can apply a very similar type of framework to the one I created in the Elemental Workplace, which is dealing with tangible realities into something a little more ethereal and a little more difficult to get our arms around, that being change. So can I take a very similar approach to something that's a lot harder to pin down? I felt when I was originally sort of just kind of thinking about the shape and structure of the book that was likely to be possible. So set myself the challenge. I can't say there weren't moments during sort of writing it that I wondered why on earth I'd actually set myself the challenge, because it's a lot more difficult, I think, to write about change than it was something so sort of evident to us in respect of a physical workplace. But at the same time, I think it really tested my experience and my knowledge of the subject, made me evaluate and question things I'd done, why I'd done them. And I think you'll see from some of the little anecdotes through the book, most of the stories I tell about my particular experience are usually those where something went horribly wrong or failed, or I'd misjudged the situation. So you know, hopefully some idea really that I'd learned from what I'd been doing over those years.
Yeah, so all good learning there, and great to have that personal experience coming in. So you did the elemental workplace, and now you've done elemental change. What's this elemental thing then? Tell us about that.
When I was thinking about the workplace book initially, I felt that if you were a sort of new entrant to the field, and there seemed to be a lot of people coming into that particular field at the time in around about 2016-17, that it was actually really difficult to get a sort of structured overview of the subject, really. What would be the ideal kind of beginner's guide? You know, so, 'cause if you, the minute you start looking at, you know, the workplace on the internet, you can be absolutely swamped with information. How do you know whether any of it is good advice? How do you sort it out, really? What sort of filters do you apply? And it could take you an awful long time. But I also found when I was doing my sort of research, really, and I used to do that research through holding discussion forums, I actually found that those people who'd been practicing the subject for a long time also, because they were so sort of knee-deep in it, they found it really difficult to step back and take that overview. And I thought, well, actually, while this might have started out as an idea for new entrants to this field, it's actually a useful refresher for all of those people who've been involved in it for years in terms of just stepping outside of it for a minute and looking back at it. So I'm quite fanatical about structure and frameworks. I like to see things drawn out in that way. I'm quite sort of spatial in the way that I organize knowledge and information. So it seemed like the natural step to take for me. And I guess all of the agonies I went through with writing the first book, well, yeah, is there enough structure around this? Have I got this set out in the right way that would make it easy for someone to understand? So the elemental approach is all about that framework. I'm using the sort of start with why principles, really, in terms of looking at the sort of philosophy and the background to it all, the sort of questioning that we might go through. The second part of it being the preparation for what we're about to do, and then the third part, the what, being the actual delivery. And I think between first book and second book, my sort of appreciation of what the elemental structure is has grown somewhat. And I think it's applicable to many different fields. I think taking that framework, it's quite easy to look at the approach and consider that you could apply it well beyond workplace and change. So if anybody thinks of anything they think that framework could apply to, then I'm very happy to have a conversation about it.
Well, yeah, we'll come back to the elemental framework, which I think is one of the really strong pieces about this book later on. But first of all, let's talk about who should read this book. Who do you want to read it? Who do you think is going to find it valuable?
Well, I tried to write it for everyone, really. I wasn't necessarily thinking about a particular type of practitioner in mind. I think sort of general management, because just about everybody in some kind of organizational environment is going to be leading change, whether it's, you know, whether it's got a daft project name or whether it's just a small scale change. They're going to be leading change. They're going to be trying to make something happen. And so I think it's applicable across all sort of strata of business and all levels of management and leadership, really. And I set out to really not to pigeonhole it. I also set out as far as possible for it to be as timeless as possible. So I'm hoping that it does stand the test of time, and try to make it sort of as entertaining as possible as well, really. I had to read quite a lot of books about change in the research, and I can honestly say I found that difficult at times, and so I thought, well, you know, actually, a lot of the things we lead in organisations in terms of change can actually be quite enjoyable. So why shouldn't reading a book about change be enjoyable too? So I've tried to make it amusing where I can, and to keep it moving at a pace, just to make it a good read as well, if that comes through.
Absolutely, I think it does. So the subtitle is Making Stuff Happen When Nothing Stands Still. And lots of books are about making stuff happen. But I think the interesting, particularly interesting part of your book is the second half of that, making stuff happen when nothing stands still. So what's the thing with when nothing stands still? What challenges does that bring, and maybe what advantages does that bring too?
When I was reading sort of a lot of the material on change before I started writing, I found that it often treated our organisational environments as something of a laboratory. And I've written this from very much a practitioner's point of view. You know, I'm not from a university or a consultancy, but actually someone who was sort of actually, you know, taking organizations through it at the sharp end, really. And I felt that a lot of what I was reading didn't reflect the incredibly messy reality of the situation we're in. So when I was looking at the sort of front end of that, the philosophical part of change, and a lot of change books gloss over that, but I think it's really important for us to get a sort of philosophical grounding in what change is and what it means, is the sort of interconnectedness of all things and the way that everything around us is moving and constantly evolving and constantly adapting. So as you suggest, I think it is both a problem and a really exciting opportunity. It's a problem in the sense that everything we're taught about planning is therefore in question. And I stress in the book, this is much more about preparation than it is planning. Planning is something we do sort of quite late in the game, but it's preparation is everything. But also in terms of the opportunity, it's almost like when we're sort of looking at a situation in front of us with everything moving, gaps will appear. That's the uncertainty. That's the space we need to step into. And if we think about organizations as sort of structural beasts for a moment, they are hell-bent on squashing uncertainty. They try to rid themselves of uncertainty. They try to create perfect information to enable people to plan. They create linear paths, with dependencies. And actually what happens in those sorts of environments is unconsciously, really, they're squashing the opportunities for creativity and innovation, because if we have a certain path ahead of us, then really nothing exciting or interesting is likely to happen because we know exactly what's going to happen. And so consequently, I think the fact that it's messy actually makes for a much more interesting, much more exciting world. It makes for a much more exciting environment inside an organization. But we have to be prepared to be in that state. We have to be prepared for things to happen that we don't expect are going to happen, to be prepared for that. But actually to see those things as opportunities, not a threat. We're so sort of, you know, risk averse and so committed to risk mitigation a lot of the time. I suggest in there that we should use the same model that we look at for assessing risk to assess opportunity as well. I've never seen that done in that way. I've never seen an opportunity map created. Actually, we need to sort of flip our approach almost, be cognizant of risk, but actually understand that with every risk comes an opportunity, and it's the opportunity that we need to grasp. And that all comes from uncertainty. So an uncertain situation is actually a good thing and is something in that sort of messy environment to be grasped and to run with.
So in the beginning of the book, the opening section, which you call the opening gambit, rather nicely, you set out a few myths of change that you want to bust and set aside right at the start. I think that's a very interesting way to tackle it, and a nicely kind of confrontational and firm way into this topic. It would be great if you talk about some of those myths and why you think we can set them aside.
Yeah, I think the sort of the worst one of all, really, is that people hate change. And it's usually said with a sort of, in a kind of, people hate change. You know, it's said as a sort of a catch-all, really, a dismissive excuse or reason for not doing something or for something not having worked out the way it was intended to work out. And what I try and stress in there, sort of just beyond the opening gambit, when we look at it from a philosophical point of view, is that change is actually the essence of being a human being. If we think about our own personal lives, just about everything that we're in, we're concerned with in our personal lives is about making things better, improving things, doing things differently. We're doing it all the time. We're always looking for inspiration. We're looking for ideas. We try new things. And we might create patterns. I think this is where the confusion comes in. You know, human beings are pattern-seeking creatures, but the reason we create patterns is that it gives us brain space and physical space to think about and do other things that might be more interesting. So we tend to impose the patterns in our life on the things that are a bit dull, bit uninteresting, likely to be repetitive. That's quite convenient because we can't have absolutely everything up for grabs at all times. We do have to do a little bit of filtering and a little bit of assessment, really, as to what's interesting. And I can put a pattern on this over here because it's quite boring, whereas that gives me the space and time to think about this stuff over here. And I think we get, it's that, as I mentioned in there, that, you know, every time I hear that expression, you know, a little piece of me dies. And I just, I'm always astounded that sort of scene. I hear it from senior leaders as well, in that sort of dismissive way. Ah, well, you know, it's never going to work because people hate change. It's like, oh, come on, you know, just think about your own life for a moment. And that's one of the things I try and stress in the book, is that you know, life is not necessarily different the other side of that, you know, real or metaphorical revolving door that we go through when we step inside of an organization. And I think, you know, in the past, we've seen that we dress differently, we use language inside the revolving door that we don't use outside. I think probably the lockdown experience and the COVID experience is going to have actually removed a lot of that from our lives. We're going to be much more comfortable with the interchange between personal and organizational life, at least for a period of time. Hopefully that won't sort of set in again. But I think that's why traditionally and typically we've thought of change as being something different, to be handled in a different way, the other side of the revolving door. And I'm suggesting that we can often resolve in our minds a lot of what it is about change and a lot of the ways we approach change in our organizational life by just thinking about our own personal lives.
Yes, and another of the things you tackle in that section, which the pandemic might also have helped to bust, is this thing that people say, that the pace of change is increasing.
Yes, I mean, I think there's probably been a lot of emails over the last year that have begun with, you know, in these unprecedented times, you know, in these times of unprecedented change. And I'm not even quite sure where unprecedented change as a phrase came from. Because I think, you know, the pace of change has always been relative to the sort of societal conditions at the time. And I don't necessarily think that the pace of change is any different now. And what I suggest in the book is actually that we have become that much more able to deal with change because we have that much more information available to us, resources, channels available to us to deal with it. So in many ways, if we can in some way prove that the pace of change has increased, then so has the pace of humanity in that sense, and that we are still in a sort of fairly appropriate sort of pairing, if you like, all as we have been through human history. We can't look back several hundred years and think, gosh, you know, nothing was particularly changing then because they didn't have the internet and they didn't have automobiles and trains and planes and, you know, all the other sorts of things we have in our society. No, I mean, you know, there have been seismic changes in history that we probably couldn't even contemplate happening now. And they all happened without any of those resources or any of that means of transmitting information that we have today. So I think it's always been relative. I think our abilities to understand and handle change have always been in step with society and with the sort of supposed pace of change. So I think it's one of those sort of empty statements that really has no basis in reality. You can't prove it in any way at all. I think there are actually some really interesting arguments that the pace of innovation has actually slowed, even with modern technology. Particularly love the story about the automatic washing machine being far more important in society than the internet in terms of what it actually brought about in terms of, you know, liberating, you know, many women from a life of domestic drudgery and enable them to start to pursue careers. I mean, I think some of those stories and some of those arguments are fascinating and worthy of some serious thinking about.
Absolutely. Another thing you mentioned in that section, which I liked very much, was to debunk the idea that we change according to a predictable change curve or something like that.
Yes, the grieving curve has become the change curve over time. And I couldn't actually find anything in the literature. I'm sure there is something, but I couldn't find it with the time I had available that sort of showed how something that was applicable in a completely different environment suddenly sort of became, or sort of rather than suddenly, sort of became over time something that we then ascribe to the way that change occurs. The grieving curve was a fantastic piece of work, and it was appropriate to the environment that it was related to. But to say that it's somehow appropriate to all change, I think, is, you know, fundamental misunderstanding of what change is and how we lead it. You know, the first stage being denial. I mean, you know, I know sometimes the odd change in an organization might raise an eyebrow or two or be a little bit of a surprise, but the fact that sort of, you know, to assume that just about every change that we lead in an organization will instantly result in mass denial is just entirely wrong. So I think, you know, it's a useful reference point, as many models of change have been over time. But I think it also, you know, completely plays against the complexity, the messiness, if you like, of the environment we're in and the environment we're moving into. And, you know, if everything moved in that very predictable line and we knew that that was exactly how change worked every single time, then there probably would have been no need for my book or many of those that came before it.
So you're saying that change doesn't follow a predictable curve. And you're also saying, I think, but that fact should not paralyze us. And on the contrary, that fact is a useful thing to be aware of as we start to tackle projects of change.
Yeah, it's a liberator. It absolutely is. I think once we can sort of get that curve out of our mind, but, you know, I'm not sure it's possible to erase it from our memory entirely. But I think if we can get some of these entrenched attitudes, like people hate change, like everything happens in this predictable curve, if we can somehow dispense with them entirely, you know, I think we'll start to really see the opportunities that are unfolding before us. And, you know, to a degree, if we can't shift those thoughts, then we're beaten before we've started. You know, we're already losing. And I'm not sure how you recover when you're in that frame of mind and you can't shift those things. So I think that's why I dealt with those things quite early in the book, because I think it's really important to say, look, good piece of work on the grieving curve, but, you know, it's applicable to a totally different situation. Leave it where it is and forget it. And let's now look at the opportunities that are unfolding before us.
So the main body of the book is into three parts. You have the first part, which is about reflection, the second part about preparation, and the third part about action. And it might be useful to start there with the beginning, your reflection part. Why are we doing this? So why do you start there? What's key about that as a beginning?
I think it's important for us to understand what change is. You know, a lot of change texts just jump straight in. Right, let's do some stuff. Let's get on with it. You know, follow this 10-point plan or this acronym and then everything will be all right. I think the fact that books are still being written about change after all of this time suggests that it's not quite all right, and it very rarely is all right, because clearly we're all feeling somehow that a slightly different approach is needed. But I thought it was important, and it is the sort of part one is kind of the slimmest part of the book, if you like, but I thought it was important to understand the infrastructure, if you like, of change. What's the grounding? The groundwork is our understanding of what change is and some of those concepts, just so we can understand what we're dealing with, really, rather than if we jump straight into getting prepared and actually delivering change, then we're not necessarily sure the reasons why we're doing a lot of this. So I just wanted to get that all cleared up, really, and just make sure that, yeah, okay, I've got my head in the right place now. Now you can talk to me about how I make change happen. I'm not going to be sort of scratching my head in places wondering why certain things are the way they are or why they're happening the way they're happening.
So you start off in that section by talking about the idea of everything being flux and the perpetual beta. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I'm a bit sort of in awe of the ancient Greeks. I think, given the sort of, you know, relative simplicity of their society, that sort of period of thought was quite incredible. And that comes from a writer called Heraclitus, who was writing in the 6th century BC. He gave us the lovely expression, which I'm paraphrasing, but you never step twice in the same river. As in, everything is moving on, and we are moving on as well. That every situation we experience is, you know, even if it looks familiar and it's in the same organization or the same kind of piece of work, that things will have moved on, that we are constantly subject to influences and sort of pressures that will be changing us and changing people around us and the situation around us. And so it's important to understand that we're operating in that fluid state. if indeed you can actually call it a state, because it is always something that's becoming rather than something that is being. And you know, the rest of the chapter really looks at sort of what the implications of that are in terms of interconnectedness, and considering really that, you know, from a sort of universal level and universal truths like that, that we will then get down to some of the, you know, more localized issues, like thinking about our values and thinking about then where the pressures might be against change, like sort of inertia and complacency. So it's to give us all really a, it's to put everybody on the same level before we begin almost. It's like agree some concepts, agree some ideas, agree what's happening, and almost say, right, okay, so we've got this infrastructure sorted now. Now we can actually look at leading change properly.
Yes, I've heard that Heraclitus thing stated slightly alternatively, as you can't step in the same pond twice either. Because people get fixed up on that the river is moving. And, of course, that's part of Heraclitus' position. But as you say, it's not the whole part of it, because the person's moving as well. The person's moving on. Yeah. And the person having stepped in the pond, you know, then the second time they're the person who stepped in it once before.
And we do forget sometimes that we're changed by these situations. You know, the situations we're in, we're inherently conflicted, because any change initiative that we're leading, we're usually involved in ourselves. So we're never sitting outside of all this. We're not sort of like an old style, you know, medieval general sort of, you know, standing on the hillside, directing troops, watching things unfold. We're involved. We're in the mix the whole time, which means it's constantly changing us. And any change initiative that we will lead, we will emerge differently from it as well. We will have been shaped by it. You know, we will have had some positive and some negative experiences. We will have encountered situations we hadn't anticipated. And the person that we are that emerges from this initiative will be different from the person who started it.
So towards the end of that section, you start talking about inertia, resistance and complacency, which I think are used as great excuses by people to not really do stuff. So what do you want us to think then about resistance and inertia?
I think these things will emerge, and I'm not suggesting for a minute that you know it's all easy. You know, nobody said it would be easy, and it isn't. I think it's important to understand the differences between you know sort of the sort of natural processes, if you like, of the sort of natural inertia that often occurs where people are processing new ideas or suggestions, and not to necessarily assume that it automatically that it's resistance. But I'm also very aware that I've encountered, you know, and been subject to many change initiatives where all of the language is very sort of resistance oriented. It's all about sort of, you know, overcoming resistance and bulldozing the way through, and it starts to use a whole lexicon, if you like, of resistance mitigation. But really, you know, our goal is very rarely 100%. And I think people often get bogged down in dealing with the outliers. And actually, some of those outliers may have really important insight to offer us. You know, they shouldn't just be dismissed. Sometimes those who are actively resistant also are that way because they care enough to be that way. And we should listen, and we should understand that they have a view. Because in all of these initiatives, you know, we're the easiest people to convince that it's a good idea. We convinced ourselves it's a good idea because we thought it was actually worth starting. So we did that some time ago. But actually, for a lot of people, they're processing it, they're thinking about it, and they may well have something that would suggest that we haven't thought about something, that we haven't thought the implications through properly, and we have to listen. And if people want to be deliberately resistant, if they want to be, if they want to remain on the outside, we probably just need to give them time. But if we get obsessed and think that the goal of a change initiative is 100% compliance or sort of, you know, getting 100% of people on board, we will get unduly sucked into dealing with those who are probably taking a little more time over this. And so I think we just need to be realistic about it and allow. other natural processes to convert those people. They will see change occurring with their colleagues, with others around them, and they will form the ideas in their own mind in time. And this is really always a problem with, and you see a lot in property, you know, in workplace, where you physically are relocating. So things do have to change because of a certain date. But if you think about sort of IT applications and large-scale IT installations, there's very often a period of parallel running when a system is moving from one platform to another, to get people used to that transition, to allow people to change in their own time, to give them the knowledge and the resources to allow them to change themselves, and to understand the opportunities that are opening up before them, and so. We just have to be really careful that we don't just assume that everything, you know, blanket is resistance. It's very often not resistance. It's people dealing with this in their own time.
Yes. An old friend once said to me that people they resist change, but they respond to making progress with things.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And so I think I like what you're talking about there, of the language of resistance ends up being very hard work. You see everything as a sort of counter push, and there are other ways to address it, and other ways to talk about it, and other ways to think about it that maybe are more inclined towards progress and success and signs of moving on and so on. In the second part of the book, preparation, how are we going to do it is the kind of key question there. And you introduced this idea of a change operating system, which I think is a very nice framework with six key bits. Share a bit about that with us.
I was considering how we prepare, all based around preparation rather than planning. So, you know, where we really don't always know what's happening, we don't have perfect information, that everything is messy ahead of us. So how do we make sure we're always prepared? And I was thinking through what I thought the sort of components of that were, and I'd used the idea of the six in the previous book, and I thought, well, I wonder if it does map to this, and I was comfortable that it did, in terms of the opportunity itself, which we've covered, developing the vision that's needed to make sure that everybody that's involved shares that ambition and that potential destination. The evidence we need, and I really focus on sort of both data and story, because they're intertwined, and we can separate them. It would be wrong not to consider leadership, because we're talking about leading change, but I've sort of not necessarily just jumped straight in at leadership. I think it's one of those components. Then I look at trust, which I think is the essential kind of lubricant in the machine, if you like, in terms of just making sure that relationships sort of move in the right direction in the right ways. And then all of those other resources that we need. And the plan is in the resources. The plan is one of those resources. But we will need a plan for short-run activity, medium-term, long-term activity. Depending on the initiative, we might need several plans. We might need to change those plans. But this is all about preparation. This is all about being ready for what we don't know. We don't know a lot of the time as much as what we do know. So this is being ready. The operating system is applicable to any change initiative anywhere at any time. And all of these components will need to be in place. There is an interrelationship between them. They support or mitigate against one another. So it's important to balance them. And the neat use of the spider chart, I think, in these instances, is to be able to measure where we think we are and where we need to get to. So, you know, have we developed that vision? Where are we? How far along the journey are we to having a vision that everyone can sign up to? We can plot it. We can work out what it is we need, and we can actually use it as an active tool, not just as a guide to preparation, but we can actually use it as we're preparing and through the change initiative itself. Because even the preparation degree will change over time in relation to all of these six components. So I wanted to liken it as an operating system, really, to the sort of operating system that runs on your mobile phone, in the sense that, yes, we like to use all the applications, but the key to all of them working is this almost unseen sort of machinery of the operating system, which just keeps everything working exactly the way we want it to. So I think it's a it's a sort of coherent and a tool that sort of hangs together for any situation at any time, even when we're not leading a change initiative. I mean, realistically, these things need to be in place, possibly without the opportunity and the specific vision, but the continual gathering of evidence, the leadership structures, the trust that needs to be there, and sort of easy access to those resources. This is a state we need to be in, whether we've got a specific change initiative running or not. And with the things like the opportunity map and the vision question, which I suppose it should be a question rather than a statement. But these are things we should be able to move to very quickly because we're prepared to do so.
I really like the way that in the evidence section of this part of the book, you include both data and stories. And I think there's a lot to be said for the kind of about the interplay of these things, because they can feel sometimes like very opposite. You know, you've got hard data and soft, vague, woolly stories, but actually the stories turn out to be a really useful, really important, and potentially really influential part of what you're doing.
And we need to tell them and hear them. I mean, it's really important that, you know, as leaders, we're able to tell stories, but we need to listen to them as well. It's a constant dialogue, which is right back to the whole idea of perpetual beta, which relies on a feedback loop that carries forward into the what section of the book when we start to talk about communication. It's a sort of recurrent theme through the book, really, the importance of open, transparent, and regular dialogue with all those people likely to be sort of subject to our initiative. But stories, you know, need data. Otherwise, they need some data. It gives them a credibility, gives them a reliability. But data needs stories as well. Data on its own is dry. It's very often uninteresting, and it needs to come to life. So data and story are, you know, they need each other to be effective. And really, what we end up with is evidence that is, you know, we might almost be unable to distinguish between what is data and what is story, because the evidence is emerging as a coherent whole.
Yes, and I certainly, as a recovering physicist myself, I'm becoming much more aware of the power of story. And when you can bring the data and the stories together, you have something that's really a really good offer to help people think about stuff. And I think that's a particularly strong element of this. At the end of this section, Neil, you talk about moving from psychological safety to elemental safety. And I think this idea of safety in change is a really interesting and slightly paradoxical topic. How do we do that, move towards elemental safety?
Well, I mean, psychological safety is sort of trust at a group level. And I think we need that trust to enable relations to be productive and purposeful rather than negative and destructive. So I think the group level trust is important. But I am fascinated by a concept that's 40 years old and we still can't seem to land the term today. It's remained in a sort of, you know, if you were to ask, a workforce of an organization, what is psychological safety? You'd probably get less than 5% of people who could even have a stab at telling you what it is. But actually, group level trust is incredibly important. So why have we been unable to transfer this idea from academia to a practical sort of grounded reality that everyone understands, recognizes, and sees as important in their working relationships and in their organization? I'd suggest it's got a brand problem. I think psychological safety just instantly doesn't feel like a workable term. But actually, I think we've really struggled to explain it. So I thought, well, and also very conscious of the fact that certainly in my career, in situations I've encountered and what we're seeing now with the COVID era, what we've seen with the Me Too movement, that we treat physical safety as something different. Physical safety is something that the facilities team look after, you know, with their sort of, you know, controlled substance registers and things and PPE. But actually, it's become part of, you know, PPE has become part of everyday life, and everybody now knows what it stands for and what it is. So physical safety is just as much part of this. And if we actually think about sort of, you know, what the Me Too movement grew out of, it was actual threats to physical safety in the working environment. which are entirely unacceptable. And so I don't think we can distinguish physical safety from that sort of psychological safety to be able to sort of hold certain feelings and hold certain views and be able to express them in the workplace in that sort of, you know, space for safe disagreement without being necessarily, you know, unduly prejudiced or held to task for it. And so all three interplay together. And where I think I'd really like this to get to is it just becomes safety. We don't need an expression before it. If it can encompass how we feel, how we express ourselves and how we actually are behaving, then effectively it is just safety. And I don't think this is anything that should potentially hold back progress, innovation, movement, change. This is something that really should give it the ability to move. It should, all of those moving pieces in front of us, our ability to move into those spaces should be enhanced by having that level of safety, because we are much less encumbered by fear or concern. We should be able to move straight into that.
I think that's a great idea, moving away from these different sorts of safety to that one over encompassing thing as being important. That's terrific. Thank you. So now we're moving through the book, Neil, and we're coming to the third part and the final big part of it, which is about action. What are we going to do? And of course, that's something that people involved in change love to rush towards. But I think you've been kind of counseling us to think about it a bit first, perhaps, in the two sections before that. And we come to these nine elements of change. And this is one of the very nice signature bits of the book, which is this group of nine elements of change, which looks a bit like a periodic table. Tell us about that and how you decided to do it that way.
The periodic table is something I used in the first book, because it was sort of the elemental workplace elements. Interestingly, one of the sort of managers that was, you know, running my work at the publishing company was a chemical engineer by training, and I was thinking perhaps using a periodic table was a bit naff, and she said, well, of course you're going to use the periodic table, aren't you? I was like, yes, of course I'm going to. So that sort of rather convinced me that it was a good idea. I think what's neat about it is it's useful as a checklist. It's useful as a metaphor because it's something although we might not necessarily understand what's going on with a periodic table. I don't really understand the relationships between sort of vertically and horizontally. What we do recognize is the format. And so I've deployed it again, not quite as interesting a pattern or a shape as last time, but I've deployed it again because I think the other thing as well is that what we're saying here is that all of these elements need to be present in a change initiative, and we need to dial some up and we need to dial some down given the situation or the circumstances we might be in, but we can't forget about any of them. And with the last book, I kept being asked, okay, so there's 12 elements. So, you know, what are the three most important? Because we always want to summarize everything. It's like, well, actually, no, I'm not happy to do that, because what's important in this is that we need to take account of all of these things. And I think the same is here with elemental change, with the nine elements of change, the things we actually do. Yes, we've got our infrastructure right, our grounding, we've got ourselves prepared, we're now ready to do some stuff. But we need, in some degree or other, to do each one of these nine things in leading a change initiative. And there is a sort of vertical relationship in the periodic table, the groups, because the first three are about being informed. So these revolve around communication in a broad sense. The second around being engaged, because that's where our sort of, you know, emotional connection comes into this. And the third being around being involved, which is, you know, physically where we're actually going to, you know, get up out of our chair and we're actually going to go and do something positive that contributes to this. And it's the combination of all of those three. It's not a critical path. We don't sort of tick them off as we go, because it could be we encourage people to start doing things before we've told them much. They could start doing things in order to get them more emotionally engaged in all of this. So the other useful thing about the periodic table is we're able to sort of move through it, across it, up and down it as we go. I'm not suggesting that there are a series of steps you have to take in order to make your initiative successful.
And I think that's what makes this book a really interesting and slightly different offer, in the change market, if I may say so, Neil. This idea of you've got these nine elements, and they're all important, but you're encouraging us to do a bit of work and join them up and see how they match up and see how they get deployed. But they're not just nine random things. There are connections and relationships between them in the way that you presented in the book, which is, I think, fascinating and revealing. And I think it's well worth a look for anyone who's interested in keeping up on the very latest in change at both a high level of principle and a detailed level of practice. We've been talking about elemental change, making stuff happen when nothing stands still, by Neil Usher. It's published by LID Publishing or LID Publishing? I'm not sure.
I think they just call it LID. I'm sure it stood for something in the early days, but it's just become LID now.
LID Publishing, $12.99 in the UK, $19.95 in the US. Probably available at a discount online if you shop around. Neil, what are you working on now? What's your next thing, having got this book done?
I have to say, the first book was it was like 25 years of experience, and I just sat down over 6 weeks and just wrote it, really. This one took a lot more thinking about, was written sort of, you know, I didn't have the same experience as the first one, where I was sitting in sort of monastic silence in a room for 6 weeks. This one was written in amongst everything else going on. And went on lots of little sort of tangents and journeys as I did in putting it together. So I think I'm a bit a bit exhausted from the emotional experience of writing this one. Writing is more emotional than most people, I think, recognize a lot of the time. So I'm enjoying the conversations I'm having with people. No intent to write another one for a period of time. I think I just want to also sort of publishing a book, there's probably a year or two of those sorts of, you know, discussions like we're having now, those sort of interactions, people getting a chance to read it, asking questions. One of the things I found with the first book is I met a hell of a lot of people as a result of writing it. You know, people who picked it up were interested. My favorite story was actually going to pitch with the company I'm working for now, GoSpace, and we went to pitch to a CFO of a large multimedia company, and I took a book with me, you know, as I was sort of quite keen to do in the early days, as a kind of calling card, really. And I slid it across the table to the CFO, and he said, "It's okay, I've already got a copy, and I have some questions." And he opened his notebook, and there was a whole page of questions on my book, because he'd read it all, which I thought was fantastic. And I thought, that's just the sort of interactions I'd always hoped for from something like this, or beyond what I'd hoped for, really. But with COVID, I still haven't ticked one little box that I want to, which is one day I want to bump into someone on a tube train reading one of my books. And that will just be one of those things that I thought, gosh, wouldn't that be amazing if that actually happened? Hasn't happened yet. We've been denied almost a whole year of traveling on the tube as a result of just that sort of chance of it happening. But I'd love to be able to go over and say, "Excuse me, I wrote that. Do you want to have a chat?" That would just be tremendous.
Wow. Well, look, thanks so much, Neil, for joining us on New Books Network today. Once again, Elemental Change, Making Stuff Happen When Nothing Stands Still. A fascinating read. And Neil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mark. Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Cheers for now.